You are listening to Lecture Number 12, Transformis LLC, delivered by Mr. Omri Traub for Computer Science E1, Understanding Computers and the Internet, at Harvard University's Extension School, on Thursday, December 15, 2005. Visit us on the web at www.fas.harvard.edu/CSCIE1.
Welcome to Computer Science E1. My name is David Malin. This is Lecture 12, Transformis LLC. Well, as you can see here, I'm not the only one talking tonight, and my words will be brief, as I'm here to introduce a gentleman by the name of Omri Traub, who is a dear friend of mine and long ago colleague. In fact, I made the mistake several years ago of working for nothing more than a smoothie for Omri, and this is a story he likes to tell quite often, so I thought I would beat him to the punch this year. The year was 1998 or 1999, and he and two of my other dear friends were starting their own company, literally out of the proverbial dorm room and then later a proverbial apartment. I offered, out of the kindness of my heart, as I like to tell it, to write a small component of the software that they were developing, specifically the installer that would install their software on millions of computers. Well, at the time, they were rather strapped for cash, to the extent that among the big business decisions at the time back then were whether or not to buy an air conditioner for the apartment in which they were to be working that summer. Well, I offered thus to work for nothing more than a strawberry banana smoothie from the wrap. It was delicious, but it was about all I got out of what turned out to be a wonderful experience and company for them, Transformis LLC. So if you would welcome with me, Mr. Omri Traub.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for that introduction. And it's I've been doing this with Dave for a number of years now, and every year I come in and some new gadget appears. So you guys are going to cutting edge of technology here. I hear podcasting is on this semester. I'm wearing not one but two microphones, and it's great. I never understood Dave's fascination with gadgets. I knew that he was sort of in trouble when he started his graduate degree by settling into his office and then installing his own email server and a firewall right in the office. He's always had a love for gadgets and technology, and I think he does a great job with this class. So I'm here to tell you a little bit about the crazy days of the internet bubble, and tell you a little bit about my experience at that time starting a company that never made it quite so big, but it's a small scale success story, and some of the fun I had doing that, and some of the things I've been doing since. And so I'll be kind of talking in two different parts. One is about the story and back in 97, 98, what it was like. And some is about my more recent experience. I work now at Liquid Machines. It's a startup company out of Waltham. And I'll talk a little bit about what is it like to develop software for a business and some of the things that I've learned since the crazy days of, me and a couple of friends trying to start a company at the dorm room. Kind of what I've learned about the real world and the real process of developing software, and kind of what a modern-day startup is like, not quite like back in 97, 98. So where were we? This is September 97. I just graduated the year before from Harvard, where I met two friends. I met Carl Shogreen, who is kind of the visionary among us, and our third partner is Alex Lloyd. Now, Alex, Carl was a junior at the time, an undergraduate, and Alex had just started as a freshman at Harvard. So I was the oldest, although not by much. I was just starting my graduate career. I had decided to stay at Harvard and start a PhD in computer science. Well, that PhD I never quite finished, but that's kind of jumping ahead to the end of that story. But so Carl, Alex, and I got together very early on in that year in September. And I remember because Alex was sort of busy doing what all freshmen do in their first week, which is, go to all these, little planned parties, talent shows. He had the kind of the ice cream social, And if you ever get to know Alex, it's not quite his scene. So he was happy when Carl pulled us together with a couple of other people and said, look, I've had this summer job, and I'm actually quite excited about starting this business around this idea. Now, Carl, I would never have come up to that conclusion. As much as I love technology, I was going to get a PhD in computer science. My first inclination of, whoa, this is a cool technology was not, let's start a company. But Carl was this kind of person, started programming at age 5 or something. In high school, this is back, in the mid-90s, he was running a bulletin board service out of his bedroom. So he had like 20 phone lines going into his bedroom. I don't know what his parents thought. And, you know, he was writing this like dial-up service, you know, that he sold at the end of the year for some local phone company for apparently enough money to finance his first year of college. So that's kind of his early success stories. He has, you know, since continued to be successful, of course, and he's now actually working at Google, as does Alex, my other partner. Anyway, so Carl is obviously the entrepreneur among us, gets us together and says, I have this idea. So I'll tell you a little bit about the idea and what he came with. He was working at the summer for a local company that was a bank, an investment bank, that had a service whereby you can trade stocks online. You know, everybody was trading stocks online then. I remember I got into investing, I think actually after meeting Carl, and I was buying all these tech stocks. I had like Amazon and IBM and Microsoft. And for a while there, like my portfolio was doubling every 2 months. And I thought, wow, you know, I could do this. I could really trade, you know. And, you know, nowadays my portfolio doesn't look like that. And actually stopped trading altogether. It's a disaster. So, you know, it went up and then, of course, that portfolio went back down. Anyway, those were the days. Tech stocks were like going through the roof. Everybody was really excited. It seems like if you're not starting a business, you're stupid. In fact, my girlfriend at the time, when she heard that we're going to start a business, she was sort of mad about it. She's like, what, you three kids, I mean, she's not 10 years old or anything, she's my, you three kids, you think you're going to start a company and you're going to be successful, you know. But it seemed like, hey, everybody's doing it. How can we miss out on it? Anyway, Carl was working at this bank, right? That's how I got into it. Trading online. The bank had the idea. Look, not everybody wants to log on to this and this website. Why not have the ability to sell our services, our trading services, to any other bank and let them customize the way the web interface feels so that it can be, you know, the Bank of America online trading site, or, you know, probably a smaller bank like, you know, Bank of Harvard Square or something, you know. So to be able to customize that web interface and have another bank offer that service if they were theirs. So that kind of exposed a problem at the time with the flexibility with which people were building websites. So you've learned about, you know, HTML and some CSS, right, and some of these technologies. The way people were writing HTML then is, you know, the content itself, the look of the page, the services that the web page was offering, whether it was the trading or the stock research, were really embedded deeply with the presentation of that page. So, you know, those tags, whether the fonts or the colors, were right mixed in with the actual content. And to actually separate them was very complicated because it was kind of one big mess of software that was both producing the data, taking the feeds off of those, you know, stock tickers and merging them with a presentation. It was very difficult to separate. So Carl's project for the summer was to come up with a kind of an early prototype using a new technology for how to separate the content, the stock information, the account information, the trading forms from the presentation in order to be able to package it to other customers. And at the time, XML and XSL that I'll talk about were just kind of new on the scene. XML was a little bit more prominent. I think you guys talked a little bit about XML. It's you know, the people love the idea of being able to not only have data, but have metadata, tags that describe the data, so-called self-describing data. So people actually could look at the data and say, oh, I understand, this is information about an individual stock, here's the price, here's the last close price, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So XML was starting to gain prominence. It was pretty clear that it was going to be something. Microsoft was backing it, IBM, all the big players. But then there was this other standard, XSL, like the extensible style sheet language, that was new on the scene. So XML had already been ratified as a W3C, World Wide Web Consortium standard, while XSL was kind of very early on in the specification and standardization process. So Carl's idea was, hey, XSL is this new way that was going to be used to write style sheets in a way that was much more flexible than CSS, the cascading style sheets. And at the time, he thought, and other people thought, that XSL may be the key to this new separation of content from presentation. That the way people were going to write their dynamic websites was to have all the data feed in XML and have all the presentation expressed in XSL. And at the time that summer, he was, you know, typing XSL and Emacs or whatever his favorite editor was at the time, and realized just how difficult it was to actually, you know, get the syntax right, type all the tag names correctly. And there were no tools for it. So there are mature tools to build websites to deal with HTML. There was Microsoft Front Page. There was, I think, Home Site back there. Allaire had Cold Fusion and all these pretty sophisticated editors and tools for working with HTML, but nothing for XSL because it was so new. Anyway, his idea to us is, let's write an XSL editor. Let's write something that's really aimed at developers who are playing with this new technology. And obviously the business idea was, let's be the first to do this, right? And so that's kind of the challenge that he gave, and that Alex and I were smart or foolish or whatever it was to accept. And so we set off, the three of us, to do this. And, you know, we were savvy enough to actually, you know, incorporate. We formed this little company to do this. But, you know, in many ways it was still three young adults just, you know, figuring their way the first time through starting a company and making a business. So, of course, the first thing we do is starting to write the product. Now, in hindsight, in 1997, the right thing to do if you had an idea was to go raise money, get some venture capitalist VC company to give you $10 million and, you know, go hire 15 people and marketing department. But we were kind of the mind that we should have something to show first. So we started working on this product. So, you know, Alex very quickly got out of the ice cream social business and started not paying particularly much attention to his Harvard classes. And I was, you know, trying to do some research, but really pretty focused on this idea. And we did a lot of the work through my grad student office. It was in an old building before Maxwell Dworkin was built, if you've been to that part of the world there. So we kind of decided to divide up the tasks. So XML and XSL, what were some of the components that we needed? So obviously we're building a tool, we need some sort of a GUI environment. And that's where Alex really shone. He was our UI wizard. He, I don't know how, at the age of 18, mastered the art of building Windows GUIs, which is extremely difficult. You know, it's just, you program in this ridiculously ancient kind of APIs that Microsoft has since, you know, had three different ways to do that are, you know, all different. But, you know, at the time, it wasn't simple to build a nice-looking, snappy Windows UI. And so he was great at that. I was sort of the academic in the group, having, you know, done research as an undergraduate. So I got the task of writing an XSL processor, which I'll describe in a moment. And Carl got the task of building an XML parser. So what is this all about? So I'll just draw you a very quick diagram. So in XML, you know, you may have something like information about a student, right? And a student may have, you know, a name. Omri is my name. And an ID number, et cetera, et cetera. So does the syntax seem familiar? Start tags, close tags. Similar to HTML, right? Except that instead of saying table, font, whatever, these are sort of arbitrary tags that you define to describe the data that you have at hand. So, you know, maybe this is what information about the student is. And this is, you know, the XML. The XSL piece is actually written using XML syntax. So you write tags that say, you know, XSL for each, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you can write some sort of a loop like that to say, for each student in your XML file, you know, create a new, you can say something like this. You can mix in your file XML, HTML, right? So here's an unordered list. And you can say li. And then you can say here something that would actually display the name of the student. So you're mixing things that are in XSL, which is the kind of the processing instructions on what you want to do with the data, with components that are in HTML, which is how to present the data. So this is a very high-level overview. So this is the XSL. So the two pieces I was describing, the XML parser, a parser is a piece of code that looks at some sort of a language and teases out the individual elements. So a parser would be able to tell that this construct here says this is the beginning of what looks like a student. So you would have the ability to, through code, say, okay, I understand that the student element is starting, and then would, for example, parse this as just a text that's embedded inside this element called name, et cetera, et cetera. So Carl was writing this piece to kind of be able to just baseline processing of this XML. And I was writing this piece that said, okay, I have an XML input file. Now let me run the instructions here, like for each student do something here, and let me produce the HTML output. Okay? So this was a very basic kind of baseline thing. And we quickly discovered a couple of wrinkles. For example, we discovered that Alex was entirely too much of a perfectionist when it comes to the GUI. So he spent actually the better part of a week worrying about the following control. We had a big application, and we had the window divided into three parts. This is where you saw your XML input. This is where you wrote your XSL processing style sheet. And this is where you saw your HTML output. This thing in the middle, this T-like thing, could be used to resize these windows. The problem is in Windows, and this is a arcane windowness, it's okay to be able to resize two windows, but there was nothing built in to let you drag this exact joining point of three separate windows and resize it. He spent a week mastering this. So it was beautiful. You know, you click the mouse here, you drag this around, you didn't see any flickering, it was flawless. After he got that done, he decided, you know, the XML is in a hierarchy, right? I mean, there's a certain tree-like structure here, just like there is in HTML, where the top level element is HTML, and then you have body, and then you may have a table, and then you may have a table entry, table row, table data, etc. So there's a hierarchy, and that hierarchy is very naturally expressed in a tree structure. Well, instead of using some sort of a built-in control for a tree, he decided that he had to write this beautiful tree. So if this is what I have on the left there, this would be the student element. It would have this beautifully drawn plus sign that when you expanded it, it would, you know, graphically show you that the student was composed of both a name and an ID. So looking at this graphically, as opposed to just the text here of the XML, will give you a feel for the structure of the data that you're processing. Well, Alex, I don't know how many weeks he spent on this one, but when you clicked on this plus sign, or that turned into a minus sign, the idea is that you're expanding the substructure of this element. The graphics there, I mean, it was like he was developing an animation picture, you know. It would, like, slowly expand in this graceful way, and, you know, it was really a work of art. The first thing we did after we got bought, which is, you know, jumping way ahead, the guy, the manager, said, you know, I love your product, but this tree has to go, because, you know what, if you have a lot of data, first of all, you get sick of this, you know, beautiful, like, slow, you know, orchestrated expansion of the tree, but it just doesn't scale. I mean, you don't have that much space on your screen to see that much data, because, you know, you're wasting all of the space just drawing this, you know, beautiful drop shadow rectangle, but it's not good for a lot of data. So that was very difficult for Alex to take. I mean, they had kind of a good relationship after that, but that was kind of a rocky start for them. Anyway, that was one of the early hurdles. We were all perfectionists, though, and never in that year that it took us to build this product did we actually have any sort of a plan. You know, Carl, being kind of the slightly control freak that he is, started using Microsoft Project. Does anyone here use Microsoft Project? This is just, you know, this tool to track any sort of project, really. So you come up with tasks, and then you'd talk about the dependencies between the tasks, and what percent of the task have you actually finished on this date, and who is assigned to which task, and you could actually automatically assign people to tasks. Of course, we had three people working on this thing that we had never done before. So yeah, he kind of made some attempts to do some sort of project management, and I'll talk a little bit later when I talk about how I've discovered kind of real software gets written, that's an important component that we sort of ignored. So no real planning, right? We did decide that in order to be a respectable software product, we had to have some fancy buzzwords for what some of our features were. So one of the things that Stylus, which is the name of this product, did from We were slightly worried that it was the name of a printer, and we later found out that it was the name of a car, an Isuzu stylus, I think. But we decided that we're probably okay from a copyright point of view. But one of the things stylus did was when you type in, for example, that's a good example. When you type in the word table in HTML, right? What are some of the other things you might want to type before you close this element name? What are those called, first of all? Come on, HTML. Table. Attributes, thank you. So, table in HTML has attributes. Any element can have attributes. What are some of the particular attributes that table can have? Width? Yeah, what else? What's that? It's been a while since I've coded HTML, but some sort of a border, right? I mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, have you all memorized exactly which attributes go with each HTML element? Right, sure. You know, some people have been doing this, but still it's a lot of typing. So what stylus did is when you type in the word table, it would automatically have this like beautiful kind of drop-down control with all the possible attributes you could be typing at any point in time. And if you hit the tab, it would complete it. So Microsoft Visual Studio, which is kind of the developer tool, calls this IntelliSense. And so we decided to name our feature SenseX. Carl came up with that one. You know, so we had SenseX, and we had all these kind of fancy names for our various features. This is way before we were writing any kind of marketing copy or brochures. Anyway, so my particular experience with this XSL piece was borderline traumatic, because what was happening is this. I don't know if you're familiar with the way specs move through the W3C, but somebody submits it. So Microsoft submitted an initial idea and said, here's a language for processing XML. Let's call it XSL. What do you think? And then they formed they accepted it, and they formed a committee, a working group, that included people from, you know, IBM and Adobe and kind of all the big players that said, okay, let's work on the standard together. And of course, once you get enough people in the room, things start changing. So what would happen is I would implement complete support for the latest spec for XSL. And then the next week, they would come up with another spec. And, you know, because this was so early on, it was changing all the time. So there were about three revisions that year, three major revisions that kind of had me back in the drawing board or the keyboard, kind of reprogramming a lot of what I had done. So that was sort of the experience of trying to be the first person, not waiting for the SPAC to be ratified and not changing anymore. I remember, it's funny how certain memories kind of stick with you for a long time, but one of the things I was doing that semester was I was auditing a music class at Harvard that was about chamber music. Any chamber music fans here? Couple. Good. This was Robert Levin, who's a great professor, the most arrogant man I've ever met. Sorry, this is going online. He, brilliant guy. I enjoyed his class thoroughly. He'd start every lecture, you know, with a student group, quartet, quintet, demonstrating whatever piece. And he'd talk about it. He's an amazing pianist. You know, he records and performs. And so he's an extremely engaging lecturer, right? So I just sit in and audit his class. And Carl was actually taking it. And I remember the morning that they announced the most complete overall of the XSL spec. He was doing this Brahms quartet, I think, not quintet. Extremely intense piece. And he was talking about, you know, giving his own interpretation of what this is about. And he's talked about the existential terror that grips, you know, the artist when he was writing this piece. And I was talking to Carl afterwards, and I was thinking, not a bad word to describe what I'm feeling at the moment, faced with this rewrite the fifth time. Anyway, we kind of survived and went along rewriting the stuff, struggling with the rest of the pieces. And, you know, finally, about midway through the year, we felt, hey, we have something working. We have something to show. Why don't we release it as a kind of an alpha release, not even a beta, to some interested people on the internet and see what they think? Well, the night before we were supposed to release this, we said, hey, well, why don't we try, you know, let's do a little testing. You know, I'll talk about software development, testing as a key part. At my company now, we have almost as many testers as we have developers. We kind of forgot about that part. So we said, hey, I can download on the internet an XML version of Midsummer's Night Dream. Okay, so you know, it was early in the days, kind of one of the toy XML things was an annotated version of all the Shakespeare plays. So it would start, you know, play, name equals Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, playwright, author, William Shakespeare, and then go on, you know, act one, act, you know, number one. You know, I'm describing the way the XML is annotating, scene one, and then it would say speaker, name equals, who can name someone from Midsummer Night's Dream? Come on. Yeah. Puck? Is that his name? The ghosts? Yeah. Whatever. So, we fed it into our editor, into Stylus, and you know what? 20 minutes later, the GUI was still frozen trying to load A Midsummer Night's Dream. You know why? Because our editor, of course, that displayed the XML, was doing beautiful syntax highlighting. So the syntax highlighting, if you guys worked with anything but, you know, Emacs or Notepad to type in HTML or something, do you know how the word table or unordered list is like in red or something, and you know, something like a text like this would be in black? You know what I'm talking about? It's just highlighting different parts of the syntax with different colors. So if you have a comment in there, it may be shaded differently, just to visually set apart the different elements of what it is that you're typing. Of course, we had to have that. I mean, basic thing that you expect from an editor. Well, turns out that there are algorithms for processing the text of HTML and actually instructing the editor component to apply the different colors was taking way too long. You know why we didn't discover this? Because for the entire duration of our development of this product, everybody was testing with two files. They were called Omri.xml and Omri.xsl. You know, and they were biased. Maybe the XML was 20 lines long and the XSL was 30 lines long, right? So much for our testing of the product. So we had a kind of an emergency discussion. We decided we can't ship to anyone a product that only handled Omri.xml and Omri.xsl. So we tried to solve the problem, which we ended up doing was throwing the whole component that did the editor piece for us and redoing that whole part from scratch. So we kind of lost a month or two of work there. So just all of these experiences of, you know, kind of failure after failure, trial after trial. One of the things we did is that as the summer came about is we decided that we need more help. And I was crazy enough at the time to, even at the summer, not treat this as my only job. And I actually taught a summer school class at the extension school. And I was actually taking a full-time job at HP Labs, research labs in Cambridge, sort of trying to do my whole research thing. So I was working kind of three jobs that summer, and we decided to hire a couple of interns. So I've got to tell you a story about one of the interns, because I thought, how we hire this person? So we kind of interviewed a bunch of people, right? Again, we never interviewed in our lives. So this guy, this kid, Harvard student, he was like a sophomore at the time, told us the story of what he did as a high school student. So this guy is into amateur radio, AM radio. You know, I don't know a lot of people who do that these days, but he was really into it. But he was also really into computers. Well, it turns out that he discovered that when he was talking to people from wherever they were, he heard a lot of typing in the background because, you know, people were talking on their little radios and typing. And he decided, wait, I know that when you type, you're sending all these signals from the keyboard to the computer that travel over the wire, the keyboard cord, the wire. And I bet that that's actually picked up by the radio that's transmitting the voice. So he wrote software that attached his computer to his radio, processed the analog signal that came in, and actually filtered out the elements of the signals that corresponded to the keystrokes, and were kind of able to decipher what the other person was typing. I heard this story and I'm like, we've got to hire this person, you know. He was great. We hired another person who's sort of a disaster. Got arrested halfway through the summer for like, you know, drunken stupor, kind of walking into the residence of one of the tutors in this, you know, dorm. Anyway. So, one good person, one bad person. That person is not Dave Malin. So, neither one. But he worked great, and he really helped us out. And, you know, that summer, we realized that, you know, we were finally ready. Midsummer Night's Dream was really snappy. All these optimizations, we were really happy. we were ready to share, we discovered, oh, small detail, you know, actually having to install that software as opposed to just have it running. So Dave was kind enough, and you know, he kind of stole my thunder there to do that for a smoothie. You know, it just shows you something about his negotiation skills. I think asking for a few options in our company would not have been a bad idea at the time. But at this point, we were working out of an apartment in Somerville that Alex and Carl rented together. So it was fun. A lot of fun memories from that summer. Well, at the end of the summer, this big moment came, and we sent an email to an email list out there on the internet called XSL List, XSL-List. So this was kind of our idea of marketing at the time. It's a single email to this list. Now, but the thing is, anyone who cared about XSL those days subscribed to this list. So some number of hundreds of people. You know, huge, long, religious debates about XSL and CSS and which one is going to win out. I remember this one email called XSL Considered Harmful, this whole thread that somebody kind of was this like whole long argument about why XSL was never going to make it, and we're kind of monitoring those discussions with interest. But we sent a single email and said, look, we are Transformers LLC. We developed this great product for editing XML XSL. Try it out. Now, of course, once again, any half-intelligent company at this point would have a publicly available beta. We thought that our product was so sensitive that the chances that Microsoft was going to see it and, you know, in 2 months write a competitive product that was going to totally blow us out of the water was just, that risk was so unacceptable that we actually, in order to download our product, everyone had to sign this binding non-disclosure agreement that they were never going to talk to anyone about it. So we actually went through this. These people had to fax in a copy of this signed NDA. But still, I don't know, a couple hundred people went through the trouble of downloading this thing and trying it out. And of course, the reason I'm here to tell you the story is because one of them decided to violate their NDAs. Actually, a couple of people. One person, of course, went to tell Microsoft about it. The other person went to tell a local company called Object Design out in Burlington about our product. And so that summer, we got a call from Object Design. We went, we did a demo for them. Now, they are a database vendor that has object-oriented databases. And I won't get into database details. There was a whole debate in the 90s between relational database like Oracle, SQL Server, IBM's DB2, between the relational world and the object-oriented. It's kind of a different type of database. And Object Design, Object Store, the product, was one of the big ones. It turns out that the object-oriented database was particularly well-suited to storing XML. So XML presents data. Data wants to be stored in the database. And these guys were developing an XML database. They were kind of one of the first to do it. Nowadays, there are a bunch of other people doing it. Well, they had the server product, the database product, but they had no tools for working with XML and XSL, and were very interested when they met us. So we had this discussion about maybe packaging our tool with our software. Well, it turns out that a day after we presented this this tool, we got a call from Object Design saying that the chairman of Object Design would like to meet with us. So we went back, and we had this, you know, nice little presentation to them, and I remember these guys were talking about, you know, Java and EJBs, and I had no idea what they were talking about. You know, this whole world of enterprise software that has nothing to do with anything that I'd ever done as an undergraduate or anything. So it was just kind of a scary experience. Afterwards, I had to ask, you know, Alex, you know, what is an EJB, an enterprise Java bean? So it's kind of, I felt a little bit like a fish out of the water there. But at the end of the discussion, the guy turns to us and says, how would you feel about kind of merging with our company? He had some sort of a phrase like that. And we were like, I suppose we would consider such an offer, you know. So within a day or two, these guys were making an offer to buy our company. And we actually got another offer from this other company. So all of this on the strength of one email to this mailing list, which is quite incredible. Now, so where were we? The truth is that we were considering, you know, what's the next step? We kind of have a product now, but we need to start thinking about sales, marketing, testing, support, you know, all the things that software companies actually do. So we were actually getting ready to write a business plan and go to VCs and ask for money and do all of that. And one of the big things that we debated was, you know, are we really serious about this? Are we going to actually quit school and go and do this full time? And this was probably the most difficult decision, you know, more difficult than the decision to actually, you know, start this company. Alex finished his first year at Harvard, you know, was he going to stop? Carl was a year away from finishing. I was starting on what I was hoping was a successful PhD plan. And so we had all these discussions, and then this offer came. And of course, part of the offer is not just to get the code, but to get the people to join. And it was, you know, are we going to take some time off and join them? And I remember, you know, Alex was very pro joining these people, working for them for a year or two, and then going back. Carl thought, hey, maybe we should give it a shot. Maybe we should, if these guys are ready to buy us now, why not, you know, give it another year, see where we can get. And so finally, Alex sort of won over, and, you know, I was sort of that opinion too, and we sold the company. Now, we did okay. We had some amount of cash up front, which is good, because I know a bunch of people at that time who sold companies for stock only and never made anything afterwards. But a large part of our compensation was option. I'll tell you that story in a moment. But Microsoft, a week after we joined, the guy who was kind of the champion for us at Object Design came to us and said, I got to tell you the story. The day you guys were signing the offer, I was out in Washington, in Redmond, talking to some Microsoft guy, and he said, yeah, Transformers, I've heard of these guys. You guys better close the deal quickly with them, because otherwise I'm flying down to Boston next week to make them an offer. So forever in my career, I'll have to wonder what would have happened if we waited another week. The truth is, I didn't want to move to Seattle, so I'm sort of happy things worked out this way. Anyway, we moved to Object Design, and things are terrible. I mean, can you imagine the energy around this, like, three-person startup, you know, enthusiasm? You go to work for this large company, and it was like, you know, the world of Dilbert come true. You know, this, like, VP of marketing guy who, you know, this is so predictable, like all the buzzwords, synergy, the synergy between our products and this competitor. And, you know, we were not doing particularly well at the time, but every meeting the CEO would talk about how we're poised for success. So, you know, actually, the skepticism came later, because we joined, the stock was at a dollar. Within 6 months of joining, the stock had hit 27 and a half. Okay? Now, you think I may have made a ton of money. My first vesting, the first time I could sell any options, was a year after I joined. So if you haven't lived through this, you have no idea what it's like to work for a publicly traded company with a stock that is going from $1 to 27 and a half. I mean, people were giddy. People were like singing in the hallways. And the amazing thing to me is these people had like 1,000 options. It's not like they were going to make millions, but just the idea that this company was like climbing through the roof. I mean, Google is doing that now. Carl and Alex are working for Google now, which I'm kind of just jealous of. But it was amazing. But 27 and a half hit, the internet bubble burst, and the corollary to the statement, you have no idea what it's like to work for a company that goes from $1 to 27 and a half, is you have no idea what it's like working for a company going from 27 and a half to 25 cents. And I was there for that decline too. So, morale, you know, in the gutter, everybody, you know, acting all depressed, rounds of layoffs, people getting laid off. So that's when, you know, the whole, like, we're poised and the synergy is great, that kind of sounded less convincing. Anyway, Dilbert kind of style, I decided, look, software engineering, this whole, like, writing software for a living is not for me, and I actually went back to Harvard to work my PhD. So that's kind of the end of the first chapter of my life in the professional software development field, and it was probably the most exciting time of my life, but I made some money from it. I never got to sell any of my options at 27 and a half. I had a window of opportunity there, I think at the $10. But I thought, hey, it's going to go back to 27 any day now. So, of course, I didn't sell as many as I should have. But it was crazy. So I want to spend the rest of my time telling you a little bit about Liquid Machines and what it's like to work for what I think is a great software company that actually knows how to deliver software and doing it at a time that's kind of less crazy than 1998. So, yeah, question.
Yeah, before you move on, did your thing that you come up with, did it take off as a product?
Great question. So we came into object design, got renamed Exelon. We continued working on the product. We had added some great features. And today, if you go to stylusstudio.com, you will see this. I mean, I get solicitation emails from Stylus now. These guys are giving away like a coffee maker if you buy by the end of the year. These guys are crazy. I mean, you can buy the enterprise version of Stylus Studio now for $700. It's now much more than just an XSL editor. It's in like version 6 now. It's got an XML editor and an XSL editor and an XML schema editor and an XQuery editor. It connects to all these databases. It's a whole development environment for like all things XML. So we, Transformers, we were definitely the first to get to the XSL editor market. The truth is now this product is probably number 2 behind another product called XML Spy that somehow managed to get enough traction on the whole XML environment. And I think we're probably number 2. But still, this product gets hundreds of downloads a day from people trying it out. It's making money. It's got a good-sized development team. I could probably be making more money at this point working for these guys than working for my little startup. But I think overall it's still there and still working. And there's still some parts of my code running in it. The XSL engine is still there. So it's fun. So at some point in 2000, my advisor at school, Mike Smith, he's a professor here, decided to start his own company. He actually started it with a guy who was my boss at HP Research Labs for the summer. So I sort of did not do a very good job at HP Labs that summer. I was a little distracted. A week before the end, I said to Voss, my boss, look, I don't think I can finish my last week. I think we're getting bought tomorrow by this other company. I have to do all this stuff. And I think part of it is, seeing all these people around him doing the startup thing that made him want to do it, my advisor too. They started this company, Liquid Machines, and they had this technology idea that they were working on, and it evolved into a product that protects documents. We now have a product that protects emails. The idea is that a lot of companies get really embarrassed by either employees walking away when they're fired with all of the important data of the company, or memos getting leaked. Isn't there like a website, leakedmemos.com or something, where you can like find all these like CEOs, saying all these embarrassing things? And it's a real liability for companies. So our product encrypts documents on disk. So if you just get a hold of the file on disk, it won't do you much good. But more importantly, when you launch Microsoft Office or Acrobat, our code runs inside those products and enforces a certain security policy. So if you send me a document, as a security policy attached to the document, may say that I may be able to read the document but not to print it or unprotect it or save any changes. So our code enforces those policies. Anyway, I don't have much time to talk about it or give you a demo or anything, but it's a fun place. So what would happen is my advisor started this company, and very early on I became a consultant, and I started doing early prototype work for them. It was in an area that was very closely related to the research work that he and I had been doing at Harvard. And so slowly the company was growing. They hired, a CEO, a VP of engineering, and I continued working for them until about 2.5 years ago. I decided, wait, there's a different way of writing software. I could be working for a company that's, fun, that only has, 10% Dilbert in it, not like 98. And that's when I left to join Liquid Machines full time. And I became a developer there, and most recently I actually managed one of the 2 development teams that we had. So what's fascinating me nowadays is not so much, what's the best way to write code? What is the coolest solution to a technical problem? The way that I was asking myself when I was doing research, what is a great algorithm or data structure? So these intellectual pursuits around technology and code. I sort of discovered the whole different side, which is how do you successfully develop software? How do you manage your software development project? And sort of, I had my own experience at Transformis, you know, three guys hacking on some code and kind of learning from mistakes the hard way, no plans, some vision, but, you know, no real rigorous process around what are the features that we want in this. Are people actually going to want this or buy this? You know, it was easier for us to imagine what people would want in an XSL editor because we were technology people, developers ourselves who would use such a product. But if you're working on a product that's for, you know, manufacturing widgets or something and you have no idea, I mean, somebody in your company has an idea about manufacturing or widgets, but you, the developer, you don't know anything about it. It's kind of hard to know what features to put in. So there's a whole process around gathering requirements, feeding them into the development cycle, getting them approved, doing design before you jump in to start implementing. So I became really fascinated with that problem of how do you do software development well. And the thing about it is that you can read these books, and they talk about how 70%, some such number, of all software projects fail. And they fail for a variety of reasons. They fail because of budget overruns. They fail because of, you know, missed deadlines. It's very hard to write software. A lot of pieces have to come together, you know. People draw analogies to engineering, you know, to constructing a bridge or something, you know. Well, it was pretty clear that, you know, when the three of us started constructing the software project, we had no such training. I mean, if the three of us set out to build a bridge, it would, you know, collapse for sure. So there is no formal training in software engineering. What they teach you at Harvard undergraduate in a computer science degree has almost nothing to do with the skills you actually need to do coding for a living. I'm finding it kind of the hard way by potentially trying to hire people. And, you know, it's great that you can, you know, compute for me the complexity of decrypting, you know, whatever. I'm sort of sore point for Dave Malin, who's engaged in an academic career in computer science. But, you know, I think there's a great place for an academic career in computer science, and people in the academia have a lot to contribute, but it's very different to write code, to do research projects, or to put together a prototype, and very different to write code to do something that would run as part of an enterprise server, or that has certain quality standards and robustness in it. There's a kind of a different process you have to follow, and people are by and large not really trained in it. Actually, the Harvard Extension School has a very good program. I think a lot of the classes that you can take here are actually much more applicable to what you need to know to be a software developer than the classes I took as a Harvard undergraduate and the classes that Harvard undergraduates are still taking and getting what they're getting taught. So I think that in many ways, it's not surprising that the extension school is very much in touch with what people who are really working and who are taking classes need to know. And I think that's, I don't know where you're all at and what your aspirations are in this field, but I think there are a lot of great things going on here at the extension school. So on the one hand, software development, software engineering is very difficult. People fail at it all the time. But on the other hand, that the premium for doing it well is extremely high, and I learned that too. You know, if you can be part of a company that does it well, that delivers, that has revenues, that builds products that people buy, the rewards are amazing. And so that's kind of where I'm at. And where I'm at is you have a team of developers. How do you get people to write software? How do you, you know, it's one thing for me to think, maybe I can do this task better than so-and-so. And, you know, it's not just me. It's maybe so-and-so thinks he can do it better than the other person. But how do I actually get all the people on the team with their different strengths and weaknesses to work together and to get the job done? And there's a whole kind of people aspect to it that you can't underestimate. The other interesting angle I have on the whole software company is that I went to this conference on software development best practices in Boston a couple months ago, and I went to a session on introverts and extroverts at the workplace. Have you guys ever taken the Myers-Briggs personality test? Some of you are nodding. It's a whole, you know, idea about personality types. One of the major things is, are you an introvert? Are you an extrovert? And there were maybe 20 people there from software companies. It's amazing how consistent it is. And it's like in my company, all of the developers are introverts, and all the people in management are extroverts. You know, how do you deal with that? You know, I was in that session and I was telling some person, you know, I'm kind of in a management role and I want to go over to someone and say, you know, what do you think about this idea or when are you going to get this done? Should I just walk over to him or should I send him an email? And this other guy who was kind of the introvert at the table said, absolutely send him an email. And I said, well, I can see where you are, you know, if he's in another location, but look, he's sitting right next to me, you know, I have a cube here, he's in a cube here. Isn't it awkward to send him an email? He's like, send him an email. So, you know, just kind of opened my eyes. It's just like, you know, some people don't like to be interrupted all the time by, you know, an excited manager telling them, oh, what do you think about this idea? Can we do this and this and this? So there is a whole lot to the problem than just solving the technical problem. And that's kind of what makes it fun. So that's kind of my new angle on that. So any questions from you guys? Anything? Yeah, go ahead. Interesting you ask that. We're experimenting with it right now. For the next release of our product, we have one of our components, a server component, being built by a team of people in Bangalore, India. Whole new dimension on the problem. First of all, we have to have our act together about what we want to build. It's one thing to change our mind and, you know, tell the person in the next queue by email or personally, oh, I changed my mind, I want this, but in India, they're 10.5 hours away. Did anyone know that you have time zones and a half hour? That it's possible to have somebody 10.5 hours off? No, I had no idea. But anyway, cultural differences, language barriers, these guys are doing a good job, but it's a whole new thing that we're playing with. The cost, though, differences is amazing. I mean, I can't give you numbers, but I know what we're paying the people on our team and these guys, I know we're paying them for the whole project and how many people they have on it, and I suppose I can do the math, but it's a fraction. But, you know, we will never outsource a significant portion of our business. We want that component for this next release. We intend to take it back and maintain it, and maybe we'll use people like that in the future, but I don't know if any of you are concerned about all the software jobs going to India. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Good question, though. Liquid Machines is now about 40 people. And today I actually made my first ever offer, if you don't count the two interns that I hired years ago. So we're growing. We're growing.
Are you publicly traded?
No. So my options at Liquid Machines are worth absolutely nothing at the moment. Yeah, one day. Our CEO likes to talk about how we're going to become the next big technology company in Boston. You know, he worked at EMC and at Akamai. He wants to build this next great company, and I'm sort of hoping that if the right offer comes along in the process, that he'll take it. But we'll see where we end up. Great. So you're going to see startup.com, right?
Yes.
Typically after me, so it's kind of the opposite side of that story, right? Tell me what you think about that. Yeah. No, I think it's, you know, people care about this. Microsoft has kind of a complementary product. We're working with them. So IBM, Adobe, all have similar products. I can see them being interested. And our customers are like banks and people who care about their information. It's not like, you know, CIA type thing. But I don't want to hold everyone up, but so if you have any more questions, feel free to come up, give you more details. But thanks.
Thank you to Omri. As he said, after a couple weeks break, we will come back and watch in real live footage the 27.5 down to the 25 cent fall off. So, thank you, Omri.
Thanks.